Can you hear me, Ted?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Great. So are you guys okay to start?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll open the Planning Commission workshop with me, Lee Nellis. Today is 6/16/20. And do I need to say who's in attendance?
No, I've got it recorded here.
Okay. All right. So you're on, Lee.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So as usual, we'll go through the kind of four steps. I don't think we need to talk about the general plan doing what we're doing tonight. We are probably going to need to come back to it after we're clear on what we agree on about these commercial development standards, but don't need to linger there tonight. In terms of consistent terminology, we talked before about how we were using C to indicate that you need a CUP in Table 1 and also using C for the commercial zoning district. And after I thought about that for a while, I decided that it might be good to fill in Table 1 with a PC with potentially compatible. So that basically says that you are potentially okay with this use if you get a conditional use permit. And then you would have other uses, a pretty long list of uses in this case that are just plain prohibited. So that was my thought, was to write a definition of potentially compatible and use that in Table 1 in the future. We're probably going to need some additional definitions. I asked you all to think about that. So as we go through, if there's something that needs to be defined, we can call it out and talk about it, or you guys can send me a list of terms that it would be helpful to have defined. And then, commercial use standards is the main topic tonight, but I was thinking about this and how to make things straightforward for people. So I did Appendix A, which is really, I hope, a simple step-by-step description of how the process would run if we make these changes. You would ask if the proposed commercial use is potentially compatible, and if it is, then they could apply for a conditional use permit. If not, then the only way that they could do business would be to amend the plan and amend the zoning ordinance, or at least the zoning ordinance. And then if it is eligible to get a CUP, we'd have a pre-application meeting. It seems to me like for things that are complex or controversial, you get a lot of the questions out of the way at a pre-application meeting, and that way the person who's bringing the thing forward can either say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't going to work, and they can make some changes and modifications to try to answer questions and deal with the issues that come up from the public at that pre-application meeting. It usually does make the final hearing on a permit easier to have had a pre-application meeting. Following the pre-application meeting, they can file an application. The administrator decides whether it's complete or not, and if so, schedules a hearing. The notice of the hearing is given as provided by law. Planning Commission holds a public hearing, as you do, and make a decision, and then the seventh step is that notice of the decision is provided. So if anything in that little step-by-step list is unclear, or there's anything that you would like me to expand upon just a bit, my goal was to keep it brief, obviously. I can do that, but I thought that would be a helpful thing to have for giving applicants or the public something that's not, you know, in ordinance language that just lays it out step by step. Are there any questions about those seven steps?
Yeah, I have a question about number seven.
Okay.
What form does that notice take? Is that something that we need to do under the current ordinances? Is it a letter?
Well, I don't know that the current ordinance requires that you do it, but it's a good practice, and there are two different ways that are equally effective say that people had a fair notice. One is to simply send them the minutes, but then that takes a while because the minutes have to be approved. So normally what happens is that there's a letter from the administrator that says, hey, on, you know, whatever date your application for a conditional use permit was approved, and approved with the following conditions. And that way they have written notice of the conditions. So I think it's just a good practice. I mean, the decision's made, right? And they're bound by it. But it also, I think, is good if you have people in the community other than the applicant who are interested. Then they can see what happened in writing as well.
I have a question on...
That all sounds controversial to me. Sorry, Cookie. Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. I wasn't sure whether or not I was muted or not. Anyway, I'm wondering about this pre-application meeting. Does it involve just the Planning Commission, or are other people present?
Yes.
It's a public...
The way pre-application works, it's a public meeting, just like any other Planning Commission meeting, but it's not advertised as a public hearing, and you don't take testimony.
Okay.
And so what you do, the other thing, maybe the most critical thing to understand about the pre-application meeting is that the developer, the applicant, does not have to have a full set of plans. They can bring a sketch and say, okay, here's what I've got in mind. Planning Commission can ask all the questions that occur to you. You open it up for the public and get questions. And that way the applicant understands what people are thinking about, what their concerns are, and hopefully will respond in making the final application to those concerns, right? Or else say, hey, wait a minute, I don't really want to do this anyway. That's another potential outcome of a pre-app meeting. But, you know, your hearings are supposed to be sort of formal. You're supposed to take it as testimony, record it, and that's hard to do in bolder circumstances, but you need to at least have that as an aspiration. The pre-application meeting doesn't have to be formal at all. You know, you can just look at the sketch that's been brought in. You don't have to have all the engineering drawings that might accompany something. The developer, the applicant, does not have to spend a lot of money up front to do it. They can say, look, here, I want to, you know, we'll go back to the garden center that I always use as an example. You know, I've got this 10,000 square foot building with sales areas around it for the plants and mulch and so on. And here's a sketch, you know, a clear two-scale sketch, but not done by an architect necessarily or an engineer. This is what it's going to be, you know. And that way people can say, well, you know, it looks to me like the access is too close to another driveway, or, you know, there's all those details, right, that you look at it and you see, hey, I have a question. And it is just so much easier to handle questions like that in an informal setting before there's a lot on the table in terms of money that the applicant has spent. The applicant can go back and say, well, people thought the driveway was too close to this other driveway. I can move it 60 more feet over and still be on my property or whatever. You know, you're having a conversation about how this could be rather than a formal proceeding. And my experience is that it makes the formal proceedings that come later much easier to have had pre-application.
I have a question.
Sure.
So you had actually put a pre-application meeting on the agenda. So then people at the end pick up, so people at the end when we have public comments could comment it on that then.
Right.
And then the next month we would have our regular public hearing.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, and it might not be the next month. It might take the applicant a couple of months to get ready, right?
Right, right.
But at some future meeting you would have a more formal public hearing. There's a cat walking on the keyboard here. Yeah, hey. So, that really, it just makes it so much easier to get people's questions out of the way. My experience is that, and I know that you guys had an interesting meeting last week, on a lot of cases, what makes public hearings take so long and what makes things seem more difficult than they are is that people have questions that have not been answered. Yeah. And if they got those questions answered, they might not even come to the hearing, right?
No.
And so you do pre-application, you know what the questions are, the developer, if they are able to think clearly at all, is going to come back to a formal hearing with the answer to all the questions.
You know, Lee, it's, we have that in our subdivision, or it's called a concept plan, and it's required. Well, I think this is a great idea. It really helps to have that concept plan or that pre-application meeting to run through everything.
I think it's a good idea, too. Yeah.
Okay, well, we will add that in at the appropriate moment.
Yep.
Are there other questions about this little step-by-step list that I've made here? Just trying to get something that you could hand people on one sheet of paper.
Yeah.
Okay. Hearing no further questions on that, we can move on to talk about the commercial use standards and specifically talk about what seems to me to be the essence of people's concerns in Boulder, which is the scale of whatever happens. And trying to keep that scale in sync with Boulder's character and with the infrastructure that you have available. And so, while there's a lot of standards here, what I want to start with is to talk about scale. And so, if you get into Appendix B, I mean, you guys have probably read what I wrote about regulating scale, and we'll come back to those things as we go through the standards. But if you take a look at Appendix B, let's skip ahead to item 6. I think this is going to be the one that takes the most conversation, the most discussion. And if we skip to item 6 and talk about how we might regulate the scale of development, I think a lot of other things will feel easier. So, people get freaked out by growth, right? For different reasons and different ways. You guys have experienced that recently. And, you know, I once worked for this town where they had, you know, they were adding a new Boulder every couple of months.
Oh. Wow.
And they freaked out about the growth, and they adopted some very, very bizarre ordinance provisions, all of which eventually came back to haunt them. The one that was the biggest problem, or maybe I should say the most immediate problem, was they decided that they didn't want big buildings, so they said a building cannot measure more than 125 feet in any dimension. Okay? So, and that would be a building somewhat smaller than the Boulder Mountain Lodge. Okay? Boulder Mountain Lodge would not have been permitted. By that. So it's not a huge building, right? And yet, if you were to put 16,000 square feet, let's say, into a Dollar General store or a Family Dollar store, and those stores are not much bigger than that, it would generate a ton of traffic, right? Yeah. If you put the same building space in a warehouse, it would generate hardly any traffic. And so, looking at the dimensions of the building doesn't have much of anything to do with the impact that the building had or would have on the community. And they got into terrible trouble trying to make that work. And we ended up having to completely redo everything. So there are arbitrary ways to address scale that almost always end up not working. But there are some non-arbitrary ways to do it. And those are all related to some type of impact that a project would have, whether visual or in terms of traffic. You try to relate your regulation to impact. And so what I've done here is I've given you four different optional ways to talk about these. And you could use all four, you could use any combination, you can tell me, no, none of that works. All those things are possible. But I want to explain the four possibilities and have people think about this. One of the most common ways that planners regulate the scale of things in a non-arbitrary way is what's called the floor area ratio. The floor area ratio is you just measure the square footage of the floors in a building, and you compare that to the size of the lot the building sits on, right? So if I had a 10,000 square foot lot and a 10,000 square feet of floor area, I'd have a floor area ratio of 1, right? Because the building would be the same size as the lot, right? It would go from edge to edge. So then your ratio is going to be some percentage of 1. And so if you're in a big urban area, you could find rules that allow an FAR that's greater than 1, because you would have multiple stories. But in the case of Boulder, what you can think about is, well, we have these relatively large lots. We want to leave a great deal of that in open space that's used maybe for agriculture, or maybe it's just in its native vegetation. So let's put on an FAR of, say, 1%. Now, the problem with that is that it sounds really restrictive, right? You can only cover 1%. 1% of a 5-acre parcel is an 11,000 square foot building. Not that small a building, right?
No.
Okay. So, like, if we go back again to my garden center example, which I generally think of as being 10,000 square feet, then it would fit. But a building that was larger than that would have some trouble fitting in. And I'm not suggesting that 1% or 5% is the right number for Boulder. You have some smaller parcels where that would be really restrictive, but I am saying that this is a way, a really simple, once you learn how to work it, way of controlling the relationship of the building to the lot that it sits on. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's really a huge part of what you perceive as scale, right?
Yeah.
If you're in downtown Salt Lake City, you have floor area ratios of 30 or 40, right? The whole lot is full with a 30-story building.
Yeah.
You're not going to do that most places. But you can see how if you just have this, then it doesn't matter what the use is. You don't have to worry about that so much. What you're doing is saying, we're going to let the open space that surrounds development soak it up, right? And so we have a limitation on floor area ratio. And floor area ratio is good because it deals with multi-story buildings, right? And you know, you're not going to have tall buildings in Boulder, but you're going to have some that are two or conceivably even three stories. So that's one option, is to talk about the relationship between the floor area of the building and the size of the lot. A slightly simpler one that is also a good way to go is to talk about lot coverage. Now, lot coverage is different than floor area ratio because it includes parking lots, sidewalks, outdoor sales areas or outdoor work areas. Like, again, in my garden center, I'm going to have some plants outdoors, right? To sell you trees, shrubs, whatever. And so lot coverage would encompass all of the space that I use, whether it's in a building or not. And the biggest part of lot coverage, besides the building, is always what parking, right? So this affects how much of the lot can be covered by buildings and parking combined. And again, you know, the way I've got this here is that you do allow a few commercial uses in the low density residential, so the lot coverage or FAR regulation there could be more strict than it would be in the mixed use zoning district. So those are two ways where use per se doesn't matter, that you regulate the scale of the building and the amount of the lot that's covered. I put really restrictive numbers in the draft that I gave you. They may or may not work out in practice. We have to think about that some, but it gives you a way of thinking about it. If the maximum lot coverage, in the GMU is, got a cat tail in front of my face here, zap. Yeah. Okay. If you're saying 10% of 5 acres, then you're talking about being able to cover a relatively small portion of that lot, and 10% may be too restrictive once you think it through. But the point, at least for tonight, is you can have a handle on the overall size of the project.
Yes.
Size. The question?
Yes.
How do you define a lot?
Well, if it's in a subdivision, it's not a surveyed lot. If you are...
In GMU, you got everything from a 5-acre lot to a 120-acre lot.
Right. And so, if I've got 120 acres and I can cover 10%, then I can cover 12 acres, right?
Okay.
That gets pretty big, and so you might want to have a cap on this. On the other hand, if I've got 120 acres, I presumably, do have some potential to use that land. And so you have to juggle what the property owner might want to do. I don't know that I see any projects in Boulder that cover 12 acres. Perhaps that would be 3 big Walmarts. With lot coverage, that would be 3 big Walmart buildings. When you add the parking with the Walmarts, it would be about 1 3/4 Walmarts. We might want to put an actual cap there besides the percentage. Again, of course, the cap ends up being somewhat arbitrary. And let's talk about the third methodology I have here, because I think it becomes relevant when we're talking about how you limit things, and maybe, in that case with 120 acres, maybe the floor area ratio or the lot coverage is problematic. One of the things I think has the most impact on the visual qualities of a community, whether it's Boulder or anywhere, but also has practical impacts like stormwater runoff, is how much parking there is. And so one of the things that I think would work pretty well in Boulder is to simply say, hey, we're going to put a maximum size limit on parking areas. And I put 15 units in the lower density residential and 50 in the general mixed use here as numbers to start with. And if that feeds back, then you can only have so large a project. I gave you the example in the memo part of a restaurant saying that if you can have, it requires basically one parking stall for every 100 square feet in a restaurant. And it also talks about counting the number of seats, but that never works. They change the seats around really easily, and they go up and down. But you could limit, if the number of parking spaces were limited to 20, you'd have a 2,000 square foot restaurant. So you can have a feedback between parking and buildings by saying, hey, we can only accommodate parking areas that are so large. We've got to keep these things down to things we can measure, right? Lot coverage is pretty easy to measure. Floor area ratio is not too hard to measure. The number of parking spaces is not too hard to measure. And then we get to the final of the four alternatives that I showed you, which is the one that is trickiest, or at least most vague, but also one that speaks most directly to what you're concerned about, and that's where where it says 40 ratio is encouraged to be compatible with that on neighboring properties. The lot coverage is encouraged to be compatible with that on neighboring properties. And those could be relative performance standards, so you have some flexibility to negotiate points for them. And so you have a range here from a fairly general standard that talks about compatibility of these measures up to more precise standards that limit the number of parking stalls or lot coverage or floor area ratio. And my sense is that there is no single version of this that works best. And that some of these may not work well in Boulder at all. But these are not arbitrary. They're related to something real out there in the world. And so I guess that I need to see what your thoughts and reactions are here and try to take the conversation on, you know, making this this work for you.
So another question.
Sure.
Is commercial under these standards defined as anything that's not residential?
Essentially, yes.
Okay. So a community center, a firehouse,
a church.
A church, anything that's not a resident is a commercial use.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, there's no reason to make life that complicated. Yeah. In Boulder, you know, yeah. And let's face it, the impacts, if you have a community center or a church that has big gatherings, then its impact on its neighbors is going to be the same as if it was a for-profit use, right? It's the number of cars and the amount of traffic that makes the difference, not whether the use is making a profit or not.
Yeah.
Okay. So we would have these limitations, and, you know, there may be, you know, and it may get back, you know, I was thinking about your question, Curtis, about what's a lot. It seems to me that in almost every case, a person who's going to do a commercial project is probably going to subdivide and create lots, but they're not required to. And so there is a good question about how you would deal with really big parcels and what might be allowed. And that would get you back to saying you have to use the numerical standards in concert with the compatibility standards and say, well, is that actually compatible with neighboring properties? And I'm also thinking here, you know, I wrote on the neighboring properties, that's the most straightforward part of the question, but you could go on to say, is it compatible with the neighboring properties and Boulder's traditional, you know, character? And that would expand what you can talk about there. So, in my mind, the rest of these commercial standards are actually fairly straightforward, although obviously we can go through them and I'll take any questions that you have, but the key to the whole thing is going to be regulating the scale.
I thought it was really interesting how you had us reconfigure Boulder Mountain Lodge as stretched out along Highway 12 as compared to how it is on that, on their property. And that is, I don't know how you'd handle that with just saying the far, looking at the 1% or the 5%. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the place to start from, is that correct? And
right.
Then
we could write a standard that is actually pretty simple, that says the long axis of buildings should ordinarily be perpendicular to the highway rather than parallel. And that would, because Boulder Mountain Lodge is quite a bit narrower there along the highway than it is long.
here.
And I think it's about 10 meters, so that would be, what, 35 feet. Less exposed on the highway side than the other side. And I think that it's also the combination of parking. If you take a look, I gotta get myself into the right place in my own stuff here. So if you take a look at item 10 here, if Peg can zip us down to item 10 there in the appendix,
that one?
We talk about, look at B there. Off-street parking is discouraged from occupying more than 60% of a parcel's frontage. So there would be a huge difference. I mean, if Boulder Mountain had parking all the way across the frontage there, that would make a huge difference in how you experience driving down Highway 12 in that part of Boulder. But instead, the parking goes on back more or less perpendicular to the highway. And maybe we could put an axis thing in here about, hey, the long axis needs to be perpendicular, more or less, and make that more clear as to what we're trying to get. But if you combine that with requiring some buffering and screening, and then you limit the size of the parking area, suddenly you have a pretty big handle on the impact. And it,
yeah.
You know, if you limit the size of the parking area, then it speaks to what Curtis's question was about on a 120-acre parcel, they could cover 12 acres, have 12 acres of lot coverage, and 6 acres of building. Well, if they can only have 50 parking spaces, then they can't have a building any larger than what 50 parking spaces will serve. So the parking, I don't know, to me, parking is critical. If you think about, and it doesn't matter whether you're walking down town in a big city or you're in one of the, you know, the smaller Utah communities, you go over to Cedar City or wherever, you think about how much is dominated by parking.
Yeah.
When you drive down the main street of any of those places.
It's true.
If Boulder is different, and, you know, in the buffering, I pointed out the state park, you know, there's big trees there, and all of a sudden that soaks up the parking, and they're fairly big, and not a huge building. I don't know how many square feet that building is, but those trees make an immense difference in what you experience going up there. So I think, you know, and you know, given the project that you talked about last Thursday, you know, the landscaping is going to be critical to how that sits on the ground there. And so if we were to deal with the parking, regulate it backwards from the parking, and make sure that the parking is not stretched out along the road, we might not even have to worry as much about lot coverage and floor area ratio. We might be able to just work backwards and scale based on parking. We're not going to have any uses that don't need parking. So that's certainly a way to keep it simple.
Yeah.
We might be able to also talk about, you know, where the parking is. I mean, there's a big difference between parking out on the highway, like you were saying, and having parking like in the last Thursday application, that all of the parking lot doesn't even start for 200 feet on the highway and behind the building. It pretty much will be, especially when the buffering is in, pretty much will be totally screened and not noticeable.
Well, you know, one of the things that we talked about with the home businesses, and that is also in here, if you can hit, let's see, which item am I trying to get us to? Go back to item 5 now. Okay, must commercial development comply with the dimensional requirements of Table 2? At a minimum, yes. But the Planning Commission may condition approval of commercial use on the provision of setbacks deeper than those established by Table 2 where it finds that a greater distance from property lines or public ways is necessary to mitigate potential impacts of the proposed commercial use. So you've got the power there to require deeper setbacks. And the other thing that I should say is we could also go change the setbacks in Table 2 and start with a deeper setback. Your setbacks are not very big at all. And so we could examine Table 2 and say, well, is it okay to bump things back further from the highway automatically? And then the Planning Commission would still have the power to push it even further back if need be. But this is actually a pretty powerful standard. If you think about it, you can shove things, you know, if you're getting back to Curtis's 120 acres of development, and they want to put in something relatively sizable, you can accomplish a lot by just pushing that back from the road in terms of, at least in terms of its visual impact. So, you know, you're never going to be able to get the results you want from just one standard. You're going to have to address these things on a whole bunch of different fronts, and we have the anti-nuisance things, which are probably not going to apply to an awful lot of what gets proposed in Boulder, but they're there. We have a pretty strict limit on outdoor sales, an outdoor workspace. You can require buffering and screening. You can push the setbacks back. And so I think you have a lot of tools in here to work with, and we might not even need to worry too much about floor area ratio. Might want to just have something simple about lot coverage. And then those compatibility standards, is the floor area ratio and lot coverage compatible with the neighboring uses and community character? And maybe that's what you need. The thing is that you guys don't process, you know, a dozen applications a meeting.
Thank God.
When I first took over the position of town planner in Williston, where they had all those growth issues, and growth was coming so fast, and it was at the beginning, before I got a handle on some things, it was routine to go to 1 in the morning. That was routine. And the biggest thing that saved us on the time was the pre-application.
Yeah.
Right? Because
that makes sense.
We would do those, and the developer would know what the public was concerned about, right? And of course, we were dealing with big developers. This was a whole different scale than Boulder ever will be, hopefully. But the developers got the message pretty quickly. Is that, okay, people are asking about this, they're asking about that. What can I do to answer their question before we ever get there, right? And then the developer would show up, and the staff would give a report of the thing and say, well, you know, you guys were concerned about the landscaping between the school and this project, and the developer's got a 40-foot wide strip of trees and shrubs in there. You know, and that's because the developer heard what the public was saying before they ever committed to a specific plan. You know, or the town, you know, the staff would say, hey, look, we don't want your access as close to these other driveways as you've shown it in your sketch plan. They could move it. And so the application that came in was better, mm-hmm. right? Because it responded to people's concerns. And when you have a better application, you at least have a chance of having a much simpler hearing. But by the time we got done, by the time I'd been there for 4 years, we were getting over a 10 pretty routinely. No more meetings, even close to midnight. We had a couple of really controversial things that we weren't able to get out of there quite as early as we would have liked. But the pre-application is what eases up the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
To me, I really like the idea of maybe a little just tweaking a little bit setbacks,
mm-hmm.
but concentrating on, like you say, the parking.
Yeah.
That's something that we can all get our minds around, and
right.
I'm pretty challenged as far as figuring out percentages. Mm-hmm. Like, visually, if I had a plan in front of me, like I was thinking, oh, a lot is 100%, so 1% of, you know, I was doing it all
right.
in percentages. But I think with the parking and really making sure that we have a landscape architect or somebody qualified to put in a good parking plan,
mm-hmm.
Almost anything, because it's that huge sea of asphalt in front of, say, Ace Hardware and Walmart and all those big things that are just so horribly ugly.
Yes.
If we could get a handle on that, it would be great.
Well,
yeah.
I felt when I wrote this that the parking was the best thing to think about, but I wanted you to see the options and
yeah.
understand that there are different ways to do this, all of which speak to the idea that there has to be a reasonable relationship between
yeah.
the landscape and what gets built on it. And, you know, we don't have to worry too much about tall buildings and Boulder. Nobody can get the fire protection or the water pressure or whatever to build one, even if you didn't have any rules. So we've got, height is not the biggest concern. It's the bulk of things, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the sea of asphalt and cars, if you try to keep the highway, you think about, you know, there are some spots along the highway in Boulder that could look better than they do, that's for sure. But there are also places where things are okay, and mainly they're okay because of the trees.
Yeah.
Right? That's...
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I just, this is so neat to be able to, I feel like you're really giving us a lot of really great tools to use with all your experience of how to head some of this stuff off. I don't know whether we can just arbitrarily, how do we go about changing, say, setbacks and putting in these, like the 15 total parking spaces, mm-hmm. or the, how do we
well,
do this?
This stuff will all become a chapter of the zoning ordinance.
Yeah, there are meetings.
We're going to rearrange the ordinance a little bit. And some of the stuff that's here is in the ordinance already in one form or another, like the setbacks, right? You've already
yep.
got them.
Yep.
And you've got a parking table that says how many spaces they need. We just need to go the other way and say that they can't have too many spaces, right?
Right.
And maximum number of parking spaces is becoming a very popular way of regulating development. For exactly the reasons you were talking about, it's the sea of asphalt, right? Nobody
yeah.
really likes to look at that. And it's very unpleasant to walk through or whatever. So, I've got a regulation here that prohibits or that gives you the opportunity to regulate business hours. I carried over the prohibition of drive-throughs and drive-ins. We've got our ordinance, our nuisance standards, which again, most of the most people are not going to bump into the nuisance standards anyway. We got buffered parking. We've got the same restriction on traffic things that we had for the home businesses, and that lets you deal with situations that are called out as traffic problems in the general plan, and we'll have to amend the general plan to have that list, new list of traffic problems in it, right? So that the general plan gives you a defensible place to start. And, you know, one of the questions I would think about is this. Suppose that I, well, let's switch off the garden center here and say that I have a commercial use I own one of the larger parcels, and besides farming or ranching it, I need another business, so I decide that I'm going to go into the business of making and selling picnic tables. Okay? I'm probably not going to have an indoor showroom of picnic tables, right? Probably not. And so we need to think about limiting outdoor sales. But then it can get really overwhelming if you're not careful. And so I've said they have to fall within the setbacks and lot coverage, and that they can't occupy more than 10% of a parcel street frontage, up to a maximum of 40 feet. So we would allow pretty small outdoor sales areas, and you could require that they be landscaped. You can't buffer them because you want people to see the merchandise that's for sale, but they could certainly be spruced up with some plant materials and, you know, pavers and so on. So we've kind of taken care of that. I guess before we meet again, that I need to have you guys think through any pieces of this that we haven't talked about tonight that you have questions about that, or that you think could be better. What I'm going to do before the next meeting is I'm going to rewrite the stuff about setbacks just a little bit. It doesn't take much change. I'm going to rewrite the scale thing to focus on parking and those compatibility measures of scale rather than the numerical measures of scale.
Okay.
Something about building orientation and parking orientation in terms of keeping it even more so off the highway than what this already does. And, you know, the reality here is you're going to get to the point where, given these rules, somebody who wants to throw up a steel building with parking in front of it, you know, the traditional Family Dollar or whatever like that, they're not going to work with this. They'll go down to Escalante. Does Escalante have a Family Dollar already?
Not yet.
No.
No. No. Well, you know, they'll go down to Escalante if they see rules like this. And what you'll get is more people who are in the mode of the Boulder Mountain Lodge who are trying to work with, you know, the assets and the character of Boulder. And no set of standards is perfect, but I think we can, if we put a maximum limit on parking, then we put a maximum limit on the size of projects.
Yeah. It's amazing how one little thing like that makes it so much easier. One little thing.
Yep. You know, it's a matter of finding leverage, right?
Yeah.
Where do you get the greatest leverage on a particular problem? And in land use, and in a lot of things about land use, it's parking and access, you know, is where the leverage is. You know, now, one thing, I didn't write it down, I actually was going to, and then I was like, I got to get this out to these people so they can read it. There is in Chapter 10, the mayor and other people have said, hey, we don't want to regulate architecture and building design. There is a section in Chapter 10 that talks about architecture and building design and uses the words jarring disharmony. And says that you can turn down something that's a jarring disharmony. And I thought about what the definition of that would look like and decided that maybe we'd have to have a different conversation. So the one thing that's not in here at all that you have to decide whether you want to talk about is the actual design of the buildings. Okay? This is about how big they can be, about how much parking they can have, about trees. You can make the building out of steel, you can make the building out of wood, you can make it out of brick. You can have the type of structure and features of the structure that you want to have as far as these standards are concerned. If you want to affect how the building itself looks, then we have to have another conversation about that. I could probably build something that's ugly enough that you all wanted to talk about it. Some of you guys have probably been to Red Lodge, Montana.
Yep.
Yep. And I was working with them. This is back in the mid-90s. And we were trying to do some things to help the community deal with its growth and development. And the owners took one of the old downtown buildings, all those buildings were built in the teens and 20s, and stuccoed the front of it, which of course is not like Red Lodge at all. They have stucco. It was all brick. And then they painted it basically the color of Pepto-Bismol.
God.
It was the greatest sensation in Red Lodge ever, you know. Just, everybody started referring to it as the Pepto-Bismol building. But that's a different reality. It's on a main street where the only thing between you and, you know, between the buildings and the road is an 8-foot wide sidewalk or a 10-foot wide sidewalk. And that is a jarring disharmony when you do that. In Boulder, where you're farther back from the road with setbacks and things, the architecture, the colors, the choice of materials begins to recede in importance. But it's up to you if you want to talk about how you to deal with that. We'll have another session where we focus on that.
Yeah, that would be great.
If you don't want to talk about it, we can not talk about it. So, is there anything else? Are there other questions? I think we do well to keep these sessions to an hour.
Yeah.
We nobody gets too tired, and I have more than enough to do after an hour of conversation. So.
I just have one more question.
Alrighty.
I've lost track of where it is that talks about how we want a parking lot to be, like to have it permeable, water or rain permeable instead of it running off into something else.
Well, there's two aspects of that, one of which is covered here by the stormwater runoff plan.
Okay.
And, you know, if you really, the problem, yeah, I don't think most people are going to pave in Boulder. I think you're going to get gravel parking lots. And they are more permeable than asphalt, but they're not nearly as permeable as ordinary soil. But since people aren't going to pave, it's going to be hard to get them to use pervious pavers or something like that as a technique to channel more water into the ground. I think that the key is to handle the runoff wherever it leaves the parking lot and make sure that it's not a nuisance to an adjoining property owner and that it isn't a nuisance to one of the irrigation ditches. And that's, I think that's adequately covered in here in a couple of different places. We've got a stormwater standard.
I couldn't find that.
Where they have to comply with Utah law about stormwater. And then we've got you can't channel, and the anti-nuisance standards says you can't channel runoff across another property without the owner's permission.
It's in there, I saw it.
Yeah,
I saw it,
I can't remember.
I think we've got it.
Oh, right here. It's in right here.
Under.
Yeah, right in here. Page 2.
Page 2.
Oh. Yeah. Well, yeah, we talk about it there, and then if you look at the standards, go on down to, let's see, let me get the right number. You've got, well, number 2, it's actually, you've got number 2, existing vegetation's retained, and then you've got number 3, I'm having trouble sorting my paper here, but 3, yeah. Must commercial development manage stormwater runoff, yes, all developments comply with Utah law. I don't think the town is in a position to be more stringent than the state law, so.
Yeah.
I think we've handled it. And then in the anti-nuisance ones, if you go over along there to 11, you've got 11A, which says you don't, well, that's not about surface runoff. You've got 11B, no commercial use should channel surface runoff onto another property in irrigation works or a stormwater treatment pond or onto a public way, except in compliance with an approved stormwater management plan and with permission of the property owner.
Right, okay.
So I think we have it reasonably well tied down, or at least as well as we can.
Yep. Okay.
Great. Okay. Great.
And so our next meeting, we're going to try doing the regular planning commission meeting.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you available on the 9th of July?
As far as I know now, I will be able to do that, and I will get stuff out to you. That's fine, and we'll go here. Think about this, and you know, if you have any other questions, we'll try to deal with them. And when we go back through this again, we need to talk about which ones are relative and which ones are absolute. And how to weight the relative ones. But I think that's too much to ask for in tonight's setting.
So that's
the checklist.
All these
that way. So,
okay.
We can do that next time, and I will get you the changes that I think we need to make based on this conversation.
Okay.
And we're going to have to, we're going to need to, desirably, going to need to write a couple of small amendments to the general plan. To go in with this approach to using parking as the main measure of impact. I think we need to say that straight out in the general plan to say, hey, this is, in our circumstances, this is the best way for us to measure impact, and that's what we're going to use.
Okay. So next meeting that you would be attending would be July 9th, regular commission meeting.
Yeah, I mean, if you guys, let's see, what would happen... Otherwise, we'd meet in 2 weeks, which I guess would be June the 30th. If you guys want to do the 30th and then the 9th, we can do that. And we could work through the policies and do the absolutes and relatives on the 30th, and that way we might be ready for a... We'd have a lot done by the 9th and be ready to talk about some other things when there are more people there.
You know, Lee,
so it's up to you.
As we spoke today, and this is just my opinion, but I really think we need to get the full planning commission on board here.
Right.
As soon as we can. I'd really like to see us wait until the 9th. I'm going to be gone on the 30th anyway, but
okay.
That doesn't matter. But I'd just like to see us get everybody on board and find out what it's going to take to start having a dialogue with everybody and what the issues are, how they want to proceed too, and get a consensus here.
Okay.
Cookie, what do you think? Cookie,
I would kind of like. I really love these handouts that you send out, Lee.
Yes.
It allows me to start thinking about things. In terms of how things are going to play out, I don't know what you would send us, but if I got one of those, maybe I wouldn't have to do this. But I have really been appreciating our regular meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Haley, are you there? Peg, what do you think? Would you?
Yeah, I'm there. I'm here. I really like everything that's being said. I think the idea of parking being sort of the main standard behind what's going to be built is seems like a great way to regulate what we want and don't want to see.
And could you meet on the 30th and then, would you be able to meet on the 30th and then the following Tuesday? Is that too much? Would you?
I mean, like tonight, for instance, my kids are here and Darren's gone. So I'm here doing my best. I mean, I'm around in the evening, so I can totally be here.
Okay, I was just kind of wondering.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm totally here.
Okay.
My evenings are usually busy, so I just might have distractions here and there.
I would think that it would be useful to meet again on Tuesday the 30th. Maybe just to catch up some stuff that is kind of loose ends, maybe to get sort of a handle on this worksheet thing. And then
go into the Planning Commission on the 9th with everybody present, and I'm wondering if, is it worthwhile having, like, scheduling a slightly earlier work meeting to start, like, regular meeting starts at 7 and a work meeting at 6:30 to get a start on it, or something like that?
Oh, what about, yeah, that's an idea.
I mean,
what about that? Okay, so that's a good idea. I could do that too. So we just have a half an hour.
Is this on July, the Planning Commission meeting?
Yeah.
Today?
Yeah.
Yeah, July. Yeah.
Would that work?
Yeah, I could. Okay. Yeah, that would work for me. I was just thinking about Haley would be having 2 hours of trying to be on the kids.
Yeah.
Well, on Thursdays he's around. It's Tuesdays that he has things going.
Oh. Oh.
So
okay.
Tuesdays are the conflict for me, but I mean,
okay.
I'm pretty present. I just
yeah.
Lee, what do you think? Could
I
you
think
be?
I think we would get some real benefit by talking on the 30th.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Try to hold it to 1 hour again.
Okay. Yep,
and
I'll be there.
You can get through this worksheet. You can see the changes that I'll make based on what we've talked about tonight. And that will include not only messing with the worksheet, but looking at a bit of an amendment to the general plan that I'll need to write up. And then by the 9th, I don't know for sure that I see what the end of this process is, but by the 9th, if we have a good meeting on the 30th, we will have a draft of everything that addresses or deals with commercial development, including home businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we need to go back through other parts of the ordinance to deal with residential and multifamily residential or other things. We're going to have to talk about what the work program looks like after we address these commercial issues. If we could talk on the 30th and then on the 9th, we will have gone all the way through the whole set of questions once, right?
Yep.
And be in a position to say, okay, we got something here that's close to workable. Let's make it better. And I would suggest that if people are okay with that, more or less, that we take what you've done with home businesses and commercial out to the public before we add other topics. You don't want to, if you can avoid it. I mean, I've done it both ways and survived both ways, but in an ideal world, you don't hit the public with, an entire zoning ordinance or a huge set of topics all at once. You break it up into pieces so that people can actually think about it. And I can see, coming out of the 9th or maybe out of one more meeting after that and saying, hey, we're ready to take this to a meeting and see what people say.
Steve, what do you think? Is that all right? Are you there?
Yes, I am. That's fine with me. Whatever you guys decide, that works for me.
Okay.
I have a question. Is Matt and Josie, I think I'm missing, are they just not available Tuesday evenings? Is that the problem for them, or?
We don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it would be good, I agree with Curtis, to just, check in with them, but I guess if we do, is that why you're thinking Thursday early, so they can be involved?
Yes. Yeah, plus, remember, there's that whole table of use thing that needs to be discussed.
That's not kind
of. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of this is them getting on the same page with what Lee has and you guys have been doing, and then the other part is, okay, how does this work with what they did? I mean, that's...
Is 30 minutes enough time?
No, not at all.
So do we need to say 6 o'clock? I mean...
Maybe, depending on Lee and...
Well, it depends on how much other business the Planning Commission has. You can
we don't have
you run your work session on into the regular meeting time and then do the rest of your business after the work session.
So far, we don't really have much
on the agenda, right?
No applications or processing. They pretty light schedule, so it's a 90-minute opportunity to have a good long session with a full 5 commissioners if we can, and really kind of figure out where everybody's coming from and see if we can get everybody on the same page.
Yeah,
maybe Colleen. Colleen, maybe you or Haley, since Haley brought it up, maybe one of you could personally invite Josie and Matt to see if that, you know, maybe there is a time or something conflict, but let them know that they're the only two missing from the commission, that it would be super helpful, and if they would join us.
I nominate Colleen.
Yeah, I think the thing is Matt made it known to us at our last meeting that he did not have the time, and Josie did too. They both said that they would not have any time available, Josie, until this fall. Did you hear that, Peg?
I think so, something like that.
Yeah, they were very clear about their time constraints, and they said they would do it on Thursday the night.
Okay, yeah, so could you do that, Lee? Would that be a problem? We could start at 6 and spend the whole hour on that.
Yeah, I still think it would be, we would make the best use of having everybody together on the 9th if we talk on the 30th.
Yeah, let's do both.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
So, and then we can go, I mean, I have no objection to going an hour earlier because it's after 10, here's where I am.
Yeah, okay.
Lee, would you be able to dedicate 2 hours if need be, or if we have other items?
And then I can go as long as I need to. I like to keep these work sessions short because I think we actually get more done in a shorter time.
Yeah.
Well, we can have they're off into their table of uses. And
right. I will take a look at what they've done and see what we can do to address that by the 30th. I'll work on the stuff we talked about tonight first, but I will also take a look at the last thing that Josie put in the Dropbox and see if I can come up with a way of addressing that. My impression is that, at least the time I looked at it before, with the first version of it, is that actually not all that much changed, but I will take a more careful look at it and see if we can be prepared to address that too.
Okay.
That would be great.
So we'll have a meeting. Oh, go ahead.
I was just clarifying, on the 30th then, do you still want to start at 7 o'clock? Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. So just same, the meeting, the same sign in and everything will stay current then, and then on the 9th we'll start at 6 p.m. and advertise it as a work meeting preliminarily, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't sound like you have a lot of other business to transact on the 9th anyway.
Right, not yet.
You okay?
Yeah, not yet. Okay, is that okay with everyone?
Yeah, and Colleen, you'll get in touch with Matt and Josie about Thursday.
So, I mean, I guess I can send them a notice, or Peg, I don't know if you want to just...
I'll do it.
That's a reminder.
Yeah, I'll send, yeah. I'll get in touch with them and just...
So just, even if you just send it out to all of us.
Yeah, send it out to all of us.
Okay.
Yeah, send it out to all of us as a reminder, just like you would normally.
Okay. So. Yep. Yes, okay. I will.
Okay, and then on the 9th, at 6 o'clock we'll be meeting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So... I guess we'll close the meeting with Lee Nellis. Thank you so much, Lee.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Everyone.
Every time we talk, we make this better. So,
yeah, it's great. Thank you so much.
We will we'll have another version to talk about in 2 weeks.
Okay, good deal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good.
Right. Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Eric, will you hang on, Peg?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Lee. Are you talking to me?